You are listening to Baseball Zealot Radio.
Okay, welcome to the show. This is show number 26. It is July 24th, 2007, and I'm Tom Nelsalpin, coming to you from Urbana, Illinois, and we have Sean Lee. He's co-hosting. Sean, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Very good, thanks. Nice to be back on the show after
quite
a long time.
Yeah, good to have you. How was the Vols game last weekend?
The Vols game was a lot of fun.
We talked about you last show, by the way.
As you know, they've recruited me as a full-fledged player, so I'm suited up in uniform, and it's a good time.
Yeah?
Good time. It's a nice way to learn about the history of the game.
I went to the Vols game last month, and I think you played the first game, and I showed up for the second game, so I missed you, so I gotta get out there when you're playing and see you play and get a few photos. But
I'm sure I'll see you there.
But Sean, I think we got a really exciting show today. We have Al Nathan. He's a professor of physics at the University of Illinois. And those of you out there are probably wondering why the heck do we have a physics professor on the Baseball Zealot Radio? And well, the reason is that Professor Al Nathan studies the physics of baseball, and Sean and I, we showed up to a lecture given by Al Nathan. What was it? Last month, I think. And Al Nathan gave a lecture on basically the effects of spin on the baseball during the flight, and taught, a full hour on that subject. And I thought it was a lot of the physics, and it's been a while since I've taken physics. I actually had a physics class in college, and I think I pretty much ditched most of my classes. Sorry. But it was pretty fascinating, I thought. What did you think, Sean?
I enjoyed it. I thought I had never gotten a kind of a scientific spin on anything related to baseball before. So I thought it was very interesting. Like you, I think I passed physics, not with flying colors, but I still enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. And Alan, I found your website and saw all the other work that you've done, and so, looking forward to hearing some more about all of that.
So let's bring on Al Nathan. I'd like to welcome to the Baseball Zealot Radio.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm doing fine. I'm ready to talk about my two favorite subjects, physics and baseball,
and the
connection between them.
Now I have to admit, when I saw the listing for your lecture, and went to the lecture, My first thought that went through my head is here's a physics professor, who's giving these lectures on the physics of baseball. How the heck did he get his unit head to let him, focus his study on the physics of baseball?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is, look, I've been a physics professor at the U of I for 30 years now, and I've had a pretty long, and I think a pretty successful career doing experimental nuclear physics, which I still do.
Sure.
I still have a graduate student. I have a big experiment that I work on with my student. But along about 10 years ago, our department has this outreach program where each one of us takes turns, usually on a Saturday morning in the fall, giving a talk usually on our research. When it was sort of my turn to give a talk, I had this book on my shelf called The Physics of Baseball by Professor Robert Adair. He's a retired high energy physicist from Yale. I had this book on my shelf for maybe 5 years, but never really had cracked a spine on it. I felt I really wanted to read the book, so I decided I would give a talk on the physics of baseball, mostly for my own benefit, so that it would force me to read the book and learn a little bit.
Sure.
And so I did that. I read the book from cover to cover. I went to some references and learned all about various things, that most of which I wasn't particularly familiar with. I gave a talk, and that would have been the end of it. That would have been
right.
End of discussion. I would have gone on to my regular business, except that a Champaign News Gazette reporter heard that I was giving this talk. He came to interview me, and wrote it up. It appeared in the front page of the Sunday paper the following day.
Wow.
And then my phone, Monday morning, going to work, my phone is ringing off the hook. People are inviting me left and right to come give talks about this, and
wow,
and sort of it's mushroomed from there. That's how it began.
So
it began innocently enough. It was going to be a one-shot deal, and that was about 10 years ago, and it's pretty much grown to the point where I spend a very large fraction of my research time doing baseball research now.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. I have to assume you are a baseball fan, then.
I am a baseball fan. I've been a baseball fan pretty much all of my life. In fact, when I give talks about this to popular audiences, I oftentimes start out by telling people that I've been doing physics all of my professional life, but I've been interested in baseball literally all of my life. So I'm a big baseball fan. Quite frankly, I don't even see how people can work on this, do the kinds of things that I do if you're not
right,
at least a baseball fan also. So yeah, I'm a big baseball fan. I love the game. I'm a big Boston Red Sox fan. I'm a charter member of Red Sox Nation. So yeah, it all fits together quite nicely for me. And actually doing research in this area has actually opened up some doors for me that might otherwise not be open. So I've gotten the inside track on a few things with baseball, with Major League Baseball a little bit, with NCAA baseball, things like that.
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice on your webpage, which, by the way, we will link into our show notes, that you had the Boston Red Sox logo, you know,
yes,
on there, so you must be pretty heavy Red Sox fan.
I am a pretty heavy Red Sox fan. That's certainly correct.
Give us a little sample or a little bit of what maybe you talked about at the lecture, or just because you know, I couldn't even do it justice.
Sure. The principal thing I talked about was the effect of the spinning ball on the flight of the baseball. So it's the spin on the baseball that makes a curveball curve, and it's been pretty well understood that that's the case. I mean, there have always been skeptics, but the discovery that a spinning ball curves was made by Sir Isaac Newton way back in the 16th century, or 15th century, I guess, or 17th century. So it's been known a long time, but it's a little bit surprising that from a quantitative point of view, that is, for a given amount of spin, how much does the ball break? That's still a matter of some controversy. And so it's a subject that has interested me, and I'm, after all, an experimental physicist. I believe that the way that physics proceeds is through doing careful experiments and then trying to understand the results of those experiments. So a couple of summers, I guess it was now 3 summers ago, I had an undergraduate student working with me, and we used some pretty fancy equipment to try to measure how much the ball breaks when it's projected out of a pitching machine. So we had these high-speed cameras, we had a pitching machine that we borrowed from the U of I baseball team, we were able to adjust the spin and the speed of the ball, and we used the cameras to track the ball and actually measured the spin in the ball, and we were actually able to do some pretty quantitative, careful measurements of how, for a given spin, how much the ball breaks.
Okay.
And mostly we were trying to resolve controversies that different people disagreed about, and in the end we succeeded in doing that.
Now, I'm not sure if this has anything to do with that, but it has to do with an old phrase that Jack Brickhouse used to say, that he used to refer to the old rising fastball, and I think he talked about it a little bit at the lecture, and I think you basically had said that it's basically essentially an illusion. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's basically an illusion. There's no reason in principle why you couldn't throw a rising fastball, and now you have to be, when you're talking about these, you have to be always careful about how you're defining things. By a rising fastball, I mean if you throw the ball level, so its initial trajectory is horizontal, can it rise? Well, if a pitcher were able to put enough backspin on the ball, you could make it rise. In fact, if you take something like a ping pong ball, and you could easily figure out a way to toss a ping pong ball with enough backspin so that it rises. Okay. Now, what makes it rise? Well, there's an upward force due to the spinning baseball that is larger in that case than the downward pull of gravity. And so, that's the pace, then the ball's going to rise. In fact, it's actually quite a common thing to see a golf ball rise. If you look at a good golfer driving the ball off the tee, the optimum trajectory to get a lot of distance is not the 45 degrees that we teach people in introductory physics courses. Instead, it's a much, much lower trajectory. The ball takes off at maybe 15 to 20 degree angle, and then you can almost see it rise before your very eyes. It really does rise, and it's because of the aerodynamical so-called Magnus force that comes from the spinning baseball.
Okay.
Again, it's the same force that makes a curveball curve, but if the ball has backspin on it, it'll rise. And that's exactly what happens. Now, can a pitcher put enough backspin on a baseball to make it rise?
Right.
Now, in principle, yes, but in practice, you would need a human being probably couldn't put that much spin on the ball.
It
would need something like 3,000 RPM. And I think most pitches top out around 2,000 RPM. So you're pretty far away from making the pitch rise. But in principle, you could. It's just that it's not really humanly possible.
So when we hear about a rising fastball, we're talking about a fastball that does not fall as much as the average fastball.
Yeah, exactly. So it's falling. It's falling anyway due to gravity.
Sure.
Okay. It must fall due to gravity. A fastball with a lot of backspin doesn't fall as rapidly as it would if there were no backspin on it.
Right.
And if a batter looks at the pitch and misjudges either the speed or the spin of the pitch, he might think it's going to drop more than it actually does.
Right.
And he adjusts his swing accordingly, and then the ball seems to hop right over his bat, and he thinks it's a rising fastball. But if you actually were to measure the trajectory, it's not rising at all. It's still falling. So the trajectory that a batter would call a level trajectory is actually falling at about maybe 8 to 10 degree angle. Okay, and so that's what he would call a level trajectory.
Right.
After all, the pitcher's mound is raised, et cetera. And the pitcher's pitching from maybe the release point is probably well over 6 feet. And 6 feet would be well over the strike zone. So the ball has to fall just to make it in the strike zone. And so it's really an illusion. The batter sees the ball not falling as rapidly as he thought, and he calls it a rising fastball.
Right. Okay. The lecture that we went to was billed in the paper as wood versus aluminum bats lecture, and that's what we were expecting. But we got the effect of spin on fly over baseball, and I was really glad we got to see that. Can you give me a little bit of a teaser on what the wood versus aluminum bats lecture might have been like? I'm just curious what you might have been talking
about.
Sure.
Yeah. I sort of changed my mind at the last minute only because, what tends to happen when I give talks is I tend to like to talk about the things that I'm currently working on.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
The couple of weeks before that talk, I was working on this aerodynamics stuff, so I decided to talk about that. But yeah, no, I've also worked quite heavily on bats, the ball-bat collision, trying to understand the differences between wood and aluminum, trying to understand how different bats perform differently, how to even define what you mean by bat performance, and then in the case of organizations like the NCAA, how to regulate the performance of bats. And that's
right.
A major big deal issue these days. So as you may know, some organizations such as New York City baseball, high school baseball, has banned aluminum bats for high school play starting in September.
Right.
There are various states, the state of New York, the state of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, North Dakota, I think, that are considering banning aluminum bats for high school play in those states. And so it's a hot topic. It's a topic that has generated a lot of discussion. And I tend to think, from a scientific point of view, that it's tended to generate more heat than light, if you know what I mean.
Right.
It's sort of a controversial topic, but it's not often that sort of clear-thinking people have been brought into that discussion. I like to think of myself as a clear-thinking person. And so I do bring something to that whole discussion. And so currently I am a member of the NCAA Baseball Research Panel. So this is the panel that advises the NCAA on issues related to baseball bat and ball and bat performance, mainly bat performance. So there are, if you look at any bat that's allowed to be used in NCAA play, it has a little label on it that says BESR certified. BESR is a name that we invented. It's called the ball exit speed ratio, BESR. Huh. And it's a result of a laboratory measurement that is done on bats, that characterizes their performance. And, so the NCAA tested, a large number initially of wood bats to measure their BESR. And then they specified that aluminum bats shall have a BESR no larger than the best performing wood bat, or maybe slightly larger just to account for measurement uncertainties.
Okay.
And so the BESR sort of measures, is a measure of bat performance. Bats that perform identically, that have the same BESR, will perform the same in the field if they're swung with the same bat speed. Now, aluminum bats generally are lighter, and the way that their weight is distributed, the weight is distributed closer to the hand than a wood bat, which is more top-heavy. And so an aluminum bat can be swung faster. And so despite the BESR limitation that aluminum bats have to satisfy, they still outperform wood. But the NCAA also has supplemental rules on what's known as the moment of inertia of a bat. That's the measure of its weight distribution. The moment of inertia is something that's smaller for an aluminum bat than it is for a wood bat, and that's what allows the aluminum bat to be able to be swung faster. So there are limits on the moment of inertia of a bat, too, in addition to these so-called BESR limits, and together these weight limitations, the moment of inertia limitations, and the BESR limitations allow you to place some pretty stringent limits on how much aluminum can outperform wood in an actual game situation. And it's about 5%, or roughly speaking, 5 miles an hour. So it is true that aluminum outperforms wood, but it's also true that left unregulated, the amount by which aluminum would outperform wood would be much, much greater than it now is. The bat companies are very, very smart people. The engineers that design that, they know how to create really hot performing bats.
Okay.
But they're not able to use those bats anymore because of these limitations. And so if you look at NCAA offensive statistics over the past decade, there was a big peak in offensive statistics, home runs per game, earned run averages, things like that in the late 90s. And in fact, one of the major impetuses for putting into place regulations on the performance of the bats was the final game of the College World Series, I think it was in 1998, but I could have the year wrong, that read more like a football score than a baseball score.
Oh, really?
21-17 or something. Balls were flying out of the stadium left and right. And if you look at things since then, since the new regulations were put into effect in the year 2000, slowly the offensive statistics are coming down to what they were more or less, say, in the mid-80s or so.
I didn't
know that. So the regulations seem to be working quite well.
Right. Huh, I didn't know that.
Alan, is the main drive then safety, or is it to control the way the game is played as far as bringing down score, or is it a combination?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. look, speaking for myself, not for the NCAA, I believe the main thing driving the regulations are the integrity of the game, bringing the game back into its traditional balance between pitcher and batter.
And no more football scores.
Injuries have always been, of course, well, when injuries happen, they grab everyone's attention. Like recently, just a few days ago, as you probably know, a first base coach for a minor league club, one of the Kansas City Royals minor league clubs, was just killed by being hit in the head by a batted ball.
Right.
This just happened a couple days ago. That was with a wood bat, of course. But when injuries happen, you know, people naturally are concerned.
Sure.
But I think injuries in baseball are, in fact, quite rare. In fact, it's very hard to get good statistics on, you know, injuries with a wood bat versus injuries with aluminum bat. In some sense, it's an unfair comparison because there are so many more aluminum bats being used now than wood bats. So it's hard to get good injury statistics for wood bats. But the point being that injuries are a fairly rare occurrence, and that, my way of thinking anyway, is not principally what's driving these regulations for NCAA. For softball is a different story. I've also consulted with the Amateur Softball Association, which is, I think, the largest of the national softball governing bodies. And back in 2004, myself and a colleague of mine came up with a new bat testing and bat regulation protocol. And there, I would say they were, there was a major concern with injuries. At least it's more of a hot topic.
Sure.
And, but once again, these bat regulations that have been put into place really do work. And so you might ask, what does a physicist have to do with all this? Well, in fact, I think a physicist can add quite a bit to the whole discussion because, in my interactions with people, I talk with the bat manufacturers, I talk with people from the NCAA, generally people associated with the game. And there's a lot of misconceptions about what you mean by bat performance, how you measure the bat performance, whether measurements that you do in the laboratory bat performance have anything at all to do with reality, with the way the game is played in the field. And I've slowly been able to convince people that, yeah, there is, physics really does work. Physics tells you that it has to work. And, you know, people are still skeptical, but slowly they're being convinced.
Okay, you're listening to Baseball Zealot
Let
Radio.
Let me follow up on...
And we have Alan Nathan, who is a professor of physics at from the University of Illinois, and he has a focus on physics of baseball. Sean, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Tom. Let me follow up on that last comment. I'm kind of curious, who do you think is still skeptical? Do you see the results of your research being used by anybody in the major league level, minor independent leagues? Just kind of want to, maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the research I do on bats, in fact, is direct input into all these issues of bat performance. But I should point out that that is not my major interest in any of this. And I don't expect, you know, I have to go back to my mentor, Bob Adair, the guy who wrote the book. And basically, Bob Adair says in the introduction to his book, or somewhere along the line, that the goal is not to reform the game by doing these kinds of studies. The goal is simply to understand the game. And when you realize that, you sort of learn a lot about how physicists think about things. We're just curious people. And so for me, it really is an intellectual endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing how the collision between the ball and the bat works, knowing what goes on during that brief instant of time that the ball and the bat are in contact with each other, knowing how a spinning baseball in flight behaves. I'm interested in studying that even for its own sake. It's just, it's a bonus that it happens to be applied to baseball. Right. Okay.
But when you watch a baseball game, you know, are you watching it as a physicist? Are you, or can you step back and watch it as a, you know, Red Sox fan? Or do you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good question. No, excellent question. When I'm watching the Red Sox play, I'm watching as a fan.
All right, good.
Because
good.
I'm so involved with it, I cannot even begin to think about the business.
Sure.
But if I sort of step back and watch a game in which I don't have a real interest, you know, in who wins or loses,
sure.
I actually do watch the game, and I believe that I have developed an appreciation for what goes on in the game, that really enriches it for me. So, I'll give you an example. I am in the process now with some coworkers of putting the finishing touches on a paper that we're about to submit for publication on why it's difficult for infielders to catch pop-ups. And so it has to do with the spinning nature of the ball. And,
right.
And if you observe in the course of... Typically, at least once per game, there's a towering pop-up to the infield. And just look at how the infielders are sort of approaching trying to catch that ball. They're going all over the place. And often, not often, but from time to time, they don't catch it.
Right.
And I think we've actually been able to develop an understanding of why that is based on the trajectory, which has to do with the aerodynamics, and based on how fielders track an object like a baseball and try to intercept it, such as, you know, trying to catch a frisbee or something like that. And as it turns out, the model that outfielders use to catch what you might call routine fly balls can actually get you in trouble if you try to apply it to these towering pop-ups to the infield. And that's sort of what we were able to show. So when I actually observe something like that happening, I get a little smile on my face. I say, yeah, I think I understand that.
Right, right.
So there's a real pleasure in sort of taking some what you might call everyday phenomenon. This applies not only to baseball, but to,
sure.
you know, other things, and sort of saying that you understand that you really understand that. I take a great deal of pleasure in that. The other thing I should say though is that I am a professor, so I teach, and I have found that talking with kids, younger people about the physics of baseball is really a great way to get kids interested in science, more generally interested
sure.
in science.
Uh-huh.
The fact that you can apply scientific principles to something seemingly as everyday as baseball, I think kids tend to be fascinated by
it. I'll tell you one thing.
Whenever I give a talk on a subject, yeah.
If your class was around when I was in college, I wouldn't have ditched all my classes in the physics 101.
Well, I'm actually going to be teaching a course in the upcoming fall semester.
Are you?
It's one of these so-called freshman discovery courses.
Right, right.
On the physics of baseball. So we're going to need
science equivalent for the LAS majors? That's what I took from my.
I don't know if it will or not. I don't know the answer to that question. It should. I should probably lobby to have it.
You should. Then you have hundreds of
people.
Because
it will be science. It will be real science
right.
that they
oh,
have
sure.
to do and understand. But mostly though, I'm hoping that as I do, that the kids that are in the class are going to have fun with it. Because
right.
after all, it is for me very much fun.
Right. One question I have. It must have been March. It had to be in March. I went to a Illinois baseball game, and it was very cold, and it had to be in the upper 30s, and I was near the home dugout, and I noticed that when the Illini baseball team was up to bat, they had a space heater in the dugout, and before the batters were up to bat, they would bring their aluminum bat over to the space heater, and they would pretty much warmed their bat up before they went up the bat, and just pretty much hold the bat up over the space heater, and you know, let it get warm. And I took a picture of it, and I sort of, you know, wrote an article about it on the blog. And one of the players noticed that, and he says, "Well, we do that because it gives the ball a chance to fly off the bat quicker." And I don't know if there's any science to that at all, or if it's mostly for good luck or what. But is there any basis to that at all? Does that ring a bell to you?
Well, look, I should say that I have not really looked into this.
Right.
But I can, as always, I can speculate. I think there's probably not much to that.
No.
One of the things, in fact, one of the amusing things, if you like, about talking with baseball players is that they oftentimes know what works and what doesn't
exactly work.
Okay, very well, better than I could tell them. But what they don't necessarily know is why it works the way it does. My guess is that heating the bat up like that probably affects the vibrational properties of the bat a little bit, so it simply doesn't sting as much if they don't hit the ball on the sweet spot.
Right.
That's my guess. There's often an illusion that when you hit the ball on the sweet spot, you have this illusion that the ball is flying off the bat just because you don't feel anything. It feels so, you know,
sure.
Feels so perfect. And people talk about, one bat has a larger sweet spot than another bat. And I think by that they don't really mean that the ball necessarily flies off the bat faster over a broader range of impact locations, but that it feels good over that broad range of impact.
And
locations.
If it works for them,
guess
you
is
can't that argue it, with
that,
right?
That it does. Sorry?
If it works for them, you can't argue
with
that.
I missed the last thing you said.
Yeah, I say if it works for them, you can't
exactly.
argue with that.
If it works
right?
for them, you can't argue. You know, it's like the cork bat argument. If a batter believes that a cork bat is helping him, then psychologically probably it is helping him. I mean, so much of hitting a baseball has to do with what's going on up in your head as
right.
much as anything else. And if you think it's helping you, then it probably is helping you, but more in a psychological way. Maybe it allows you to relax more knowing you're
right.
thinking you have an advantage and then you see the ball better as a result or whatever.
Sure.
This is another study I did a few years ago when Sandy Sosa got caught using his cork bat. And in fact, I think I never talked to as many reporters over a short period of time as I did for that one. And I was convinced that for somebody who wants to try to hit the ball as far as possible, a home run hitter like Sammy Sosa, that a corking the bat doesn't really help much at all.
No.
In fact, it probably hurts more than helps. It probably helps you if you're sort of a contact type hitter, a singles hitter.
Sure.
Where or doubles, you know, hitting the ball in the gap, line drives, not
right.
long distances, but you know, between the fielders kind of thing. You know, you get better bat control because it's lighter and you're able to wait on the ball maybe a little bit longer. But if Sandy believed that it helped him, then it probably helped
right.
him in some
sure.
psychological way. Just like wearing pink socks might help him.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
But
right.
if a batter you know, got four home runs wearing pink socks, that he's, by God, he's going to contribute pink socks.
Right. Okay, well, we've been talking to Alan Nathan. He's a professor at the University of Illinois. His focus is on physics of baseball. You're also a nuclear physicist, is that correct? And I don't want to minimize your...
Yep.
Your effect at the University of Illinois, but I do think that is a really awesome way to reach out to the community. I mean, you did have quite a crowd at the lecture that we went to. Just to change gears real quick here before we go, what do you think the Red Sox chances are? You think they pretty much got wrapped up in the AL East right now?
Oh, no. I would never be so brazen as to say they have it wrapped up. It's not over until it's over.
Sean here is
the Yankees.
Sean here is a Yankee fan, so watch your words here.
Ah, okay. Oh no, no, no! I keep on looking in my rearview mirror, seeing that Yankee machine, you know, trudging along behind. And yeah, the Red Sox are going to have to continue to play well in order to win. Having said that, I'd rather be 7 games up than 7 games down.
Right.
But you know, there's still a lot of games left to play, and in particular, the Red Sox have to play the Yankees head to head 6 games. So
what do you got? What do you got lined up for the fall? Anything as far as any sort of lectures or anything that you're studying or working on?
Well, I've got a whole bunch of different things, of course, that I'm working on at any given time. I told you about this course that I'm teaching. I'm going to be giving a lecture at the Early American Museum in Mahomet at Lake of the Woods sometime in September, I think. And I'm giving a talk for the LAS Alumni Association at Busch Stadium.
Oh, no way.
For a Cub Cardinal game sometimes in September. I don't remember exactly when it is, but sometime in September.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah. So if you're an LAS alumnus of U of I, you could probably come to this.
Okay. Well, I want to say I really appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
And my pleasure.
I think it's great. It's great what you're doing. And, I do want to say, I would give out the web address for your site, but it's about a mile long. I will say that we'll link it in our show notes. So please check it out. Show 26. Check it out because you have a plethora of information on the website, on your website. It's a lot of papers that you've written, a lot of information that you've linked to, just a lot of really good information that I think that baseball fans I think would be really interested. And one last thing, and something that you've turned me on to that I think a lot of baseball fans would find interesting is the data that MLB Game Day is making available to just about anybody. Would you like to just quickly go over that?
That's correct. If you go to MLB for any game and look at, not any game, but almost many games, and look at their game day, this is the pitch-by-pitch account of the game. You'll see this year there's, for many of the stadiums, there is something called extended game day, which provides more information than you otherwise had on each pitch. And like it tells you how much the pitch broke, and it tells you the direction that it broke, and it tells you the speed of the pitch. And this is all determined from cameras that are mounted in the stadium and sophisticated software for reconstructing the trajectory of the pitch. And it turns out that all of that data for stadiums that have this facility in it, and I think there may be a dozen of them or so now, there are at least 8. And I think St. Louis is about to come online. In fact, I'm going to have a tour of their facility when I'm in St. Louis over the weekend for the Sabre convention. I was just last weekend I was in Fenway Park. The weekend before last, I was in Fenway Park.
Oh wow!
And had a tour of their facility.
That was a treat for you.
All of that data is available online to anyone who wants to download it at. And as a result, people have gone through elaborate analyses of what the types of pitches that different pitches throw, location, release point. I mean, there's a tremendous wealth of information. I've used the data to try to determine some of the aerodynamic parameters, the so-called drag coefficient and the lift coefficient. I think most people are not using the data quite that way, but at the upcoming Sabre meeting that's taking place this weekend, the Sabre and Science Committee that I'm actually the chair of will devote its entire meeting to talking about, we'll have 3 different speakers, I'm one of them, who will talk about the kinds of analysis that they're doing with this data. There'll be an MLB representative there that hopefully we can quiz him about the continued availability of the data. But this is, I believe, the new wave of scout. Even I think if I were a major league scout and I wanted to look to see You've got all these basically digitized data on what kinds of pitches the pitcher is throwing, location, release point, speed for different hitters in different situations. And for someone who's at all computer-minded, they could make very, very good use of that data.
I bet they can.
And it's all for free.
Right, right. Now it's for free. Yeah, we'll definitely link that. And you have that on your website, too. So we will...
I've been meaning to put up some links that directly tell you how to download the data, where to go to get
well,
it.
I'll go ahead and link that on our show notes. So we'll go and put that link on our show notes. Anyway, I've taken up way too much of your time. I really appreciate you being on the show. It's been great having you. Thanks again.
Okay, well, enjoy. My pleasure.
And hopefully we'll talk to you again. Maybe I'll see you at one of your lectures.
Sounds fine. Look forward to it.
Thanks, Alan.
Good talking with you.
You take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks, Alan. We enjoyed it.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, we're going to close out the show. Sean, that was really interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, it's a neat perspective to really hear about baseball from, you know, that scientific perspective. He mentioned Robert Adair, the fellow, kind of that groundbreaking book, The Physics of Baseball. And I don't know how many other peers, Alan Lee has today in his field. I think it sounds like he's breaking quite a bit of ground, and
right,
he's got a lot of ears who are
no kidding,
who are willing to listen and are very curious into what he's finding out. Interesting stuff.
It's funny you mentioned the Adair book, because a friend of mine lent me that book, and like I was cramming that book last night just to prepare for this interview, because like I said, I don't have a physics background, but I was just skimming through that book last night just to get a feel for, what I could, talk to Alan about. But you're right. Yeah, he's definitely a very intelligent man who obviously has the smarts, and like you say, he's got the ears of the way it sounds, Major League Baseball and Sabre, and yet he still has time to enjoy, the Boston Red Sox as a fan, and I really appreciate that. It's not all intellectual to him, and that's great.
I think you raised the point during the interview when you were talking about the Fighting Illini players heating up their bats, is that throughout history, to get players just do what works.
Right.
I don't think probably count them on one hand how many of them really understand the scientific principles behind what works. He's answering the question of why it works.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that nobody's really, I won't say nobody, but as far as I know, very few people have tried to do the research to figure these things out. So it's interesting to hear about his results.
Yeah, he made it clear at the lecture that he and people like him are not out to go and correct the coaches and the players and say, you should do this and you should do that and you're doing this wrong. He's not out to, be that way. But like you say, it's basically this is how baseball works. This is why it works. Essentially that he basically shown how the game is played and how the game works at its very base level. It's very interesting. Alright, I think we're gonna close the show out. If you have any comments about this show, this is show 26. Please email us. Our email address is baseball. Oh boy, I tell you, it's been a long show. Our email address is feedback@baseballzealotradio.com. If you want to give us a call, leave some voicemail, you can do that too. Our phone number is 217-883-4571. And if you want to check out our website, you can check out our blog. Our blog is thebaseballzealot.com, or the podcast website is baseballzealotradio.com. Any last words? When's the next Vols game, Sean?
I have to check the schedule. You might want to put a link out there.
Yeah, I'll do that.
If you don't have it already, but their schedule is online.
Right.
And I will just like to say to you know, because Alan mentioned he was a Red Sox fan, that I'm glad he's looking in his rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, the Yanks are doing doing all right. That's for sure. We'll see. And as far as the Cubs, well, same goes for the Brewers, right?
We'll see. I think they're probably going to catch them.
I'm looking at the Vols schedule right now, and it looks like August 4th at Kennecuck Meadows, you're playing the Deep River Grinders at 1 o'clock. So it'll be a couple weeks. But yeah, it's just a couple weeks. And
if anybody's in the area listening to this, come on out. It's a great time.
It is a great time. It really is. I'll definitely vouch for that. It's a lot of fun. So anyway, that's it. Any last words, Sean?
It's nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you back, Sean. It really is. Okay, we're going to close out. Talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.